Curious City is supported by the Poetry Foundation, with a reminder that Chicago is the pulse of poetry. Visit the Poetry Foundation on the corner of Superior and Dearborn to explore their library of 40,000 books, attend public events, and view Frente a la Vida, Facing Life, a striking multidisciplinary art exhibition by Chicago artist Victoria Martinez. Learn more at poetryfoundation.org. WBEZ's nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
What's up, Chicago? I'm Erin Allen, and this is Curious City. Right now, I'm in Rogers Park. On my way up to a special area just above the Howard Brown Health Center.
Welcome to Gerber Heart. Excited to have you here.
It's called the Gerber Heart LGBTQ Plus Library and Archive.
We are one of the biggest LGBTQ Plus library and archives in, certainly in the Midwest, if not the world. So
that's
pretty, I would say the world. Yeah.
Okay. In our last episode, we looked at some queer history, specifically where queer women in Chicago hung out in the 1920s and 30s. Today, I'm at a place that's dedicated to preserving that type of history.
So my name is Erin Bell. I'm the operations director here at Gerber Heart.
And I'm Jen Dentel. I use she, her pronouns. I am our community outreach and strategic partnerships manager.
These are the folks who showed me around, Erin Bell and Jen Dentel.
You're standing in our library right now. So this is a LGBTQ plus circulating library. So anyone over 13 can check out up to 10 items at a time for free. So all of these books are LGBTQ books. So it's a mix of fiction, nonfiction, graphic novels. We've got a big YA and kids section too.
This is not a part of the Chicago library system, and it's not a part of any university system either. It's an independent resource for anybody interested in learning, citing, or exploring LGBTQ plus history.
Ooh, so we are standing in a room which I know personally contains thousands of books.
Erin and Jen clearly love this place.
The walls are a kind of mint green, but sometime last year we added a little pop of lavender over there. It's technically Mighty Aphrodite is the color.
So I asked them to explain to me why it exists and give me a tour of the archive side of things. Like, what's actually inside of the largest LGBTQ plus archive in the Midwest?
We have boxes and boxes of the earliest Chicago gay newspapers. So we've got Gay Life, the Chicago Gay Crusader, we have Lavender Women, we have the Blazing Star.
There's a lot.
It's so much.
Picture narrow rows of books and pulp novels.
There's travel guides down there, which I absolutely love. They're like LGBTQ plus travel guides.
Dolls, queer-themed board games. Some unique memorabilia.
You might see behind you, there is a large tongue. again, it's 50-50 if someone immediately sees it or not.
The tongue is 3D, 6 feet tall. It's a mouth with a large tongue hanging out. Apparently, it was an old feature of a drag disco bar called Carol's Speakeasy.
It was named for someone named Mother Carol, who was known for being super loud. So it was like a loud mouth. We've got the mouth for Carol. We got it in the 90s.
There's a whole bunch of file cabinets.
I'll just open one of these here. So these are like newsletters. Oh yeah, Chicago Byways was a bisexual group. Women's Aid. Okay, the Chicago Smelts is still going. It's a queer swimming group in Chicago called the Smelts. So we have their newsletters here. But yeah, there's just a lot of fun treasures. Magazines, periodicals.
Chicago also, gay hockey.
Chicago gay hockey. Yeah, do you want to talk about that?
And in fact, there was a pretty significant sports section.
The Chicago Gay Hockey League. So they reached out and said, like, hey, we're, you know, we've been around for a while and we realize we've accrued all of this material about our history. So they wanted to donate it to Gerber Heart. And that was a really special day. I would say that's been one of our biggest surprises is how much of our collection actually centers around queerness and sports.
Why do you think that is?
Because it's a place where people can come together, especially like an all queer team, a place to come together and know that like you're not maybe not going to face the same amount of ostracization and bullying that you might have faced in a team that wasn't explicitly queer. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a lot of trauma around participating in sports for queer people, especially from their youth. And so to have a place where you can play the sport you love to play with your friends and family in a safe, warm, welcoming environment is just wonderful.
The other thing in our collection that always surprises me is how much religious materials we have here, mm-hmm. too. So a lot of like queer affirming churches and synagogues. We have a lot of those materials, which for me personally, I don't understand based on my own, you know, religious trauma as a queer person. But it is something that I think is important to a lot of people.
Sure. Aaron said people use items in this collection all the time. So that means researchers, documentarians, and also just everyday people who want to explore the history.
It's really great to be able to go through those papers and to see headlines from big events, from especially the early, documenting the early gay rights movement in Chicago too. With some papers going back to 1970, 1971, you can see like reportings on the very first Pride Parade. And then you just get to follow the timeline of progress.
It was at this point that we moved to a section with some spicier material.
We say erotica. Outside of the library, you say pornography. Same thing.
The archive has a lot of erotica.
Sassy little men on the covers, and it was supposed to be for straight women.
And just to be clear, we're not in the public-facing library side.
Right.
All this is stowed away on the archive side.
Women's erotica we have.
And there's everything from your more hardcore VHS tapes from the 1980s and 90s, to old magazines from the 1960s and 70s.
So these are what would have passed as gay erotica before 1969. You're gonna find a lot of muscle magazines, physique pictorial, bodybuilding magazines, things that perhaps some of them did originally start as a bodybuilding enthusiast magazine, and then they realized who their readership was and who their audience was.
How normal or common is it for an archive to collect erotica just in general?
I would say fairly uncommon. I think that there are specialized archives like the Kinsey Institute in Indiana is all about sexuality. I think it's something like erotica, particularly like this sort of stuff, like VHS tapes, DVDs. I think it's often dismissed as that sort of trash, you know, so it is not viewed as worthy of collection. I think it is something that can raise some eyebrows when it comes to grant applications, when it comes to government, you know, sort of funding. So it is, there are risks that come with it. I think for us, because our mission is to collect, preserve, and make accessible LGBTQ plus history and culture, erotica is part of that. So erotica is part of queer culture. So we collect it.
That's kind of what I'm getting at. I have never, you know, seen anything like this inside of a museum that wasn't specifically focused on sexuality or sex in general. And so to have this whole section here, it seems important to note that it is here partially because, you know, this is a part of the history.
Absolutely. And I'll say too, there is so much, obviously, there's just so much value in this collection and being able to see what, you know, the erotica trends were, what, who the models were, how it was like pre-AIDS and post-AIDS. There's so much research value here.
Mm-hmm. Jen and Aaron showed me another archival gem. It was this cable access TV show called The 10% Show. Quote unquote 10% being a reference to famous sex researcher Alfred Kinsey's claim that 10% of people are gay.
It was a national publication. There were segments from all over the country. There were segments about Chicago and the Midwest, too. And it was like a talk show, kind of man on the street interviews.
Sarah Siegel, and I'm here with Fawn Adams and Deb Gould.
Aaron and Jen pointed me toward one particular segment from the show. A group of lesbians staged a quote-unquote kiss-in on Michigan Avenue in 1989.
How did you come up with the idea?
Well, we were just sitting around one day and we were worried, we were thinking about, you know, our invisibility, not only in the straight world, but also in the gay community, because it's always gay men who get all the media coverage and get everything.
First of all, Aaron, what is a kiss-in?
Kissin' is where a group of folks get together and as a demonstration and act of resistance, and people get together and they smooch it up.
Okay. And then what caught your interest in that particular segment?
It's just this very unapologetic, I think, expression. And I think at a time, you know, I think often women aren't talked about in the queer movement. So I think centering women in that space was really wonderful.
I want to have the chance to hold hands and a kiss like other people get to all the time.
All right. Give us a kiss.
There's a couple in the Kissin' that I really love. So it's this couple, and the interviewer asks them something about, like, aren't you worried about making straight people uncomfortable?
It's a good idea to be right here in front of the water tower, or do you think you're alienating straight people?
And, like, the little, like, femme partner just, like, goes off on his, like, no, I don't care at all about that.
No, I think it's a good idea that we're here because the straight people can see us and they're just going to have to deal with it.
I think there's this idea. This is part of our collection, so we'll go in the archives and show, like, you know, everything else that we have. Sure. This is part of who we are. But I do think, yeah, I think queer people get kind of reduced to a sexuality, but then I think the way to become acceptable is to deny your sexuality, and there has to be a medium between there. So I think that's why we collect what relates to our culture, and this is part of our culture.
It was at this point in the tour where just being in the space had me feeling a certain way. This area is making me really emotional. As a queer person, I sometimes feel reduced down to just my sexuality or just what I do sexually. But the history represented at Gerber Heart covers so much more than that. It makes you feel whole.
Yeah. No, it's a really powerful space to be in here, and to especially, like, to be around the archives and to be around the library. I think there's a reason why we come back and why we wanted to work here and to make this our jobs. We're very passionate about this.
Gerber Heart is named after two 20th century LGBTQ pioneers. Henry Gerber, who founded the first American gay rights organization in 1924, and Pearl Hart, an attorney known as the guardian angel of Chicago's gay community. Its mission is to advance this larger goal of achieving justice and equality.
So we started in 1981, and it was a project that grew out of, I think, a lot of, you know, 1970s, there was this flourishing of community archives and this idea of people are not documenting our history, so we need to document it for ourselves. So where are these materials going to be kept safe? Where are they going to be celebrated? I think a lot of LGBTQ people, when they were passing away, their materials were being destroyed by family members that didn't understand them. And so having a space by us, for us, where we would collect and preserve the history became really important. Yeah, because there is a lot that is lost. And I think there's a loss that's also, like, so much of history is in people's attics and basements. So a lot of it's still out there. And it's something that we're always looking for people to give materials to us. Those photos of you and your friends growing up are critically important. And again, it's a record of our existence.
This is an independent archive, not associated with university or the government. Is that significant? Why is that significant?
So I think it's really significant because when you see certain, like, government laws or rules coming into place that are affecting state archives, or you see, like, people having their funding taken away by the government under this current Trump administration, for example, that's something we are independent of. So we are not, you know, we don't have any government funding. We were hoping to apply for some this year, but that won't be happening. But yeah, I think being independent from another organization means that we choose what we can collect. I think it's also tenuous. I think there's definitely been periods in our history where the doors have almost shut. Like, we don't have that safety net that comes from being part of a university or a government organization. But when it comes to access, like, there aren't those barriers to entry. I think if you've done research at a university, often you have to either be part of that university or you have to prove you have a certain level of credentials to be able to access materials. We're a community library and archives. We're here for everyone. You can just be interested. You can be curious. You can be a community member. So I think that that's something we want people to feel really empowered. This history is for them to use. And that's, I think, one of the beauties of a community archives.
Yeah. Speaking of the feds, speaking of the government, the federal government has made several anti-LGBTQ plus moves this year. And even this month, Pride Month, there's the symbolic name changes of a Navy ship named after gay activist and icon Harvey Milk. There's also most recently the Supreme Court decision upholding Tennessee's ban on transgender care for minors. As these things happen, how do you think about the role of the archive? Does its role change or take on a different meaning?
I think we both have a soapbox we could stand on with this. I think that it certainly shows the relevance of our work. I think you see how information is being targeted, particularly information about queer people, for young people, for anything to do with gender, for sexuality. I think that information is under attack when they're redacting things in like HIV research, when they're firing the National Archivist, when they're firing the Librarian of Congress. Like, libraries, information, queer people are all very much under attack right now. So I think it shows the relevance of our work, why it's important to keep records to show that. I think something you hear a lot is this idea of like trans people being a new thing, for example. It's like, absolutely not. Like, there is no world, there has never been a world without trans people. And just because they have been oppressed in such a way where they have not been public, doesn't mean they didn't exist. And I think that having access to our stories, I think also to our elders, we just did a queer elder history panel at Dorothy on Friday. And one of the people asking questions at the end was getting really emotional and said, I think the reason why being able to hear from these elders and hear these stories, like, we know that you've been through this and you've helped us like realize what we can do to fight back against this. This is the same rhetoric we saw in the 70s. Like, this is something that we can fight against. So nothing is new that they are saying now, and we can look to history to figure out how to fight back against it.
Erin, yeah, what would you add to that?
Just the fact that Gerber Heart is a space where people can feel free to come here and be themselves and to find themselves in the shelves.
Erin Bell is the operations director at the Gerber Heart LGBTQ plus Library and Archives. Erin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Jen Dentel is the Community Outreach and Strategic Partnerships Manager. Jen, thank you.
Thank you.
You can find more information about Gerber Heart at gerberheart.org, and that's H-A-R-T. And be sure to check out their podcast, Unboxing Queer History, where they use this massive archive to tell stories about queer people throughout Chicago history. Season 1 was produced by WBEZ's own Ari Mejia, and season 2 is scheduled to come out later this year. This episode of Curious City was produced by me and Justin Bull. Susie Ahn is our editor. Curious City is a production of WBEZ Chicago and is a part of the NPR network. If you have questions about Chicago and the region, send them our way. Email us at curiouscity@wbez.org or visit us at wbez.org/curiouscity. I'm Erin Allen. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next week.
Rise and Shy, WBEZ is serving local stories for breakfast every weekday morning from 5 to 11. Tune in on the WBEZ app to hear what Chicago's talking about as you start your day.